Zechariah, chapter 11, 12, 13, and 14. We are going to discuss it just a little bit tonight, but, you know, I looked at chapter 11. And after I had kind of skipped over it a little bit, asked you to kind of take a look at it and see what you think. Did anybody do that?
Yeah.
Get a chance to look at chapter 11. It is a little bit confusing. But he starts this chapter with a symbol of God's judgment on Israel, and especially their leaders for their rejection of God's appointed shepherd, who is who?
Jesus.
Yeah, God's appointed shepherd, the Messiah. And their preference for listening and buying off false prophets. It also highlights the consequences and neglecting God's true leadership and the rise of greedy and corrupt authorities. And we've studied a lot about that, haven't we? The prophets that we've studied earlier that point to some of the greediness and the false prophets and how they were paid off to prophesy good things for certain people. It kind of covered the greed and the corruption that went on, especially in the leadership of the nation, not only of Israel, but of Judah as well. In the beginning of chapter 11, God instructs Zechariah to act like a foolish shepherd, to illustrate the corrupt leaders who will arise over Israel. And this foolish shepherd also represents the Jews from accepting, Jews from accepting the true shepherd, who is Jesus. And what do we find as we go on through through this New Testament? They accepted Jesus, right?
No.
Okay. So Zechariah was told to break his two staffs. He had picked up a couple of sticks or rods, and he called one favor. And the second one he called union. And what, does anybody know what that signifies?
That's the covenant that Jehovah had with Judah and Israel.
Okay, that is correct. And he broke both of these staffs, you remember. And what was that, what did that signify?
Took my staff and cut it into pieces to break my covenant, which I have made with all the people.
Yeah, give it to us. Yeah. So this was, this rod named favor, this rod named union, represented God's covenant with the Israelite people. And when he broke that, he's demonstrating the fact that he is no longer honoring the covenant that he placed with Israel and with Judah. And that now he's and this is not going to be, once you break this up, not going to be reconcilable, is it? So there's no hope for reconciliation in this particular case with God. Excuse me just a minute. Okay. Because God and his appointed shepherd were rejected by Israel, and we find the impending destruction of Jerusalem and the Jewish nation. Zechariah mentions 30 pieces of silver. Somebody asked me about that. Was that you, Bill, that asked me about that last week, 30 pieces of silver?
Yes.
Somebody asked me about, was it Kristen? Okay. Asked me about that and whether or not that represented the 30 pieces of silver that Judas paid for Christ. And I told her I didn't think so, but I studied this a little bit, and I think you're right. I think it was.
It was from what it says, right?
Foretell of what they paid for, Judas was paid for.
That was the price of a slave.
I'm sorry?
That was the price of a slave.
Yeah, it wasn't even the price of a slave. But it wasn't a whole lot of value, was it? Just worthless, basically. So what happened? Did they do, what did they do with the money?
They bought the potter's field.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what they did was they dropped it in a coin slot in the temple, which was for poor people that were not able to provide burial for themselves, potter's field. Okay, and Zechariah, of course, we all know about the Jewish betrayal, and Zechariah refers to this, Jesus' betrayal. He was the true and only shepherd that was betrayed by his own people, wasn't he? Okay, that's really all I had to just do a quick review of chapter 11. Anybody have any comments to say or questions?
A question.
Yeah, Bill.
The very end of that chapter, it speaks of a worthless shepherd. Who is that?
Well, that's the people that, I think that refers to the people who were false teachers, false leaders, that type of thing.
Not just an individual, but a group of people.
No, I think we referred to a group of people, yeah.
Pharisees and Sadducees?
Well,
false prophets?
Well, we know the Sadducees were about kind of out of space, but, you know, I guess you could include them in there, you know, false teachers, they misled the children of Israel, misled the people, and because of that, they were destructed. Yeah.
Something I noticed, I just read through Kings and I'm in Chronicles now. In the beginning, God didn't want Israel to have a king. He was their king. And he said all the things their kings were going to lay on them. But he didn't tell them that these kings were going to lead them to destruction. Because they followed their kings. However their king went, they followed. The good kings, they were good people. The bad kings, they were bad people. And eventually, Judah went worse than Israel did. And he led them to destruction. They led them to destruction. If they had been good kings all the way through, they probably would have lasted longer.
Well, I think the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, the combination there, lasted about 200 years after the country of Israel, after the split. Israel didn't have one righteous king on the bunch. At least Judah had several that came along and tried to do right, although they were fighting uphill battles.
Yeah.
All the time, but you know, Hezekiah was a good king, and he did very well for the time that he had. But Josiah was a good king, but he was fighting an uphill battle all the time. Most of them were, but they tried to do what was right.
As you said, Bill, they had a good king in God. And they yeah. refused to follow him.
He was the one they should have followed.
Well, but that tells you about the people.
But God, you're right, God did warn them. I've worn them through, I think it was Samuel, that spoke about the what's going to happen to them if they like they wanted to be like everybody else around them. And up until that point, everybody did right the way they wanted to do it. They didn't have any king. And so they did whatever was right in their mind. I think that would be a pretty good way to go. He didn't have, he outlined what they were going to get. They were going to, their children were going to be subdued and put into the army, drafted. They were going to have taxes. Somebody had to support the government. And he listed a whole lot of other things on top of what the burdens. Well,
yeah.
You know, you remember Solomon?
Oh, yeah.
David and Solomon, they taxed the people to death to build the temple and build the city, build up the city of Jerusalem. And it was one of the main reasons why the country of Israel went by the wayside, because they went to Rehoboam, Solomon's son, said, hey, you know, we're being taxed to death, we need some help here. And the older people went to Rehoboam and spoke to him about that, but he didn't take their counsel. He was more interested in listening to the younger people, and they said, hey. So he says, I'm going to tax you even more. You think this is bad?
That just doesn't make the least bit of sense. Who wants to be taxed more?
So Israel went by the wayside.
The king wasn't taxed. He doesn't understand.
So basically, that's what happened with the split. Of course, we know this was poor. They were forewarned about this. God had Jeroboam. He was away, and he took off into Egypt, I believe, to get away from Solomon. And as soon as Solomon died, he came back, and that was the beginning of the children of Israel going on their own pathway. Of course, he saw the problem, the people still going to Jerusalem to worship, and so he set up the calves in that way. You always see that referred to as the sin of Jeroboam. Okay, in Zephaniah 12, 13, and 14, chapter 12 begins with a description of God's power. And of course, we know that he has unlimited power. This has a description of some of God's power. He laid the foundations of the earth. Well, we know that, don't we? Stretched out the sky. Yes, he did. He made man. What are the things? Where do we have a description of God's power? Job, Isaiah, talks about how powerful God is. And of course, Genesis 1, chapter 1, describes God's power. But it's interesting when you look at some of the descriptions of how powerful God is. It is awe-inspiring anyway. It really is. And how anybody can look around and see the evidence of God in existence. How in the world can they ignore that? It's absolutely non-existent. It just blows my mind. William F. Buckley. Does anybody remember him? William F. Buckley. William F. Buckley. He was a philosopher. I don't know exactly what his background was, but he was very, very brilliant. IQ off the charts. And he was on a program one time that I was trying to have a commentary, and somebody asked him, do you really believe that there's a God? He said, absolutely. He said, there's just too much evidence that points to the existence of a maker, superior maker. And so this guy was no dummy. Well, he met Bucky. But he was very adamant about the fact that there was definitely a superior being. There was just too much evidence to ignore. I thought that was kind of interesting. He said he'll make Jerusalem a heavy stone, and that anybody that tries to move Jerusalem, these stones are going to get hurt. So they must have been super heavy. In verse 10 on chapter 12, there's a picture of Jesus called the staff component of the house of David. Is that right? Jesus was of the house of David? Okay. And it points to a story also of a family who's lost a firstborn son and their grief and their sorrow. And this refers to what is going to happen when Jesus is crucified. That it's like someone losing an only son, and how much grief and sadness there is and sorrow. And we saw that, didn't we? Okay, in chapter 13, Zechariah prophesies about a day of purification for the Israelites, including the somebody wanting my autograph. Okay. Anyway, the abolition of idols, abolition of false prophets, and a fountain for cleansing from sin and uncleanliness. 13 also describes the killing of Jesus and the scattering of the saints. And we know about that. We remember Jerusalem was destroyed in what?
70.
AD 70, yeah. By the
Romans.
Romans, yeah. And the people were scattered. There was persecution in Judea. 13:8. Chapter 13, verse 8. Let's take a look at that. The Lord says 2/3 of the people through all the land will die, and only 1/3 will be loved. What does this describe? Anybody know?
Sounds to me like the faithful are going to be saved and the other will be destroyed.
Well, take a look at Matthew 24:16-21. Somebody read that for us. Matthew 24:16-21.
When therefore ye see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophets, standing in the holy place, let him that reads understand. Then let them that are in Judea flee unto the mountains. Let him that is in the housetop not go down to take out the things that are in the house. Let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that you suck in those days. And pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath. For there shall be great tribulation, such as hath not been from the beginning of the world until now, no nor ever shall be. And except those days had been shortened, no flesh should have been saved but for the elect's sake. For those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is the Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you beforehand, if therefore ye shall they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the wilderness, going on forth. Behold, he is in the inner chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh forth from the east, and is seen even unto the west, so shall be coming in the coming of the Son of Man. Whosoever, wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together.
Okay, thank you. Somebody read Mark 14, 27. Mark 14, 27.
You will all fall away, Jesus told them, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.
In Matthew 26, 31.
Then Jesus said to them, you will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike down the shepherd and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered.
Okay. Well, we know that the Romans invaded Judah in AD 70, destroyed the temple, and they killed 2/3 of the people. Rest of them, they were warned, weren't they? Don't, if you're in the field, don't go back and pack your bags. You don't have time. Get out. Same way with people standing on the rooftops. You know, don't go back down in your house and fix yourself a going away snack. You got to get out of here now. Woe to the woman who is carrying a child. I was reading a piece about the what the Romans did, and they had found a tunnel, and there were like 3,000 people hiding in this tunnel, and so they just poured oil in there and set it on fire, and they discovered their remains during an archaeological dig. And it just proved out what they had done back in those days. Really said, the Lord's day is coming. Second, let's take a look. Oh, let me spend a little bit of time there. Anybody aware or familiar with the Calvinistic? Calvinistic beliefs.
Once saved, always saved.
I'm sorry?
Once saved, always saved, basically.
Well, that's probably part of it. There is certainly a doctrine like that.
Predetermination.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is.
But they think that during Jesus' second coming, and this talks about it right here, and they use this Zechariah as a pointing to a definite conclusion about what's going to happen, and that is that Jesus' second coming, he's going to set up an earthly kingdom in Jerusalem.
I have a friend who believes that true and true.
Oh yes, and it's very, very difficult to have them take a look or even want to discuss it.
Right.
And they point to Zechariah as a conclusion for their belief. And see if I can.
I
Now let's start out here at the day of punishment. The Lord's day of judging is coming.
What verse?
This chapter 14.
Okay.
Yeah. Lord's day of judging is coming. The wealth you've taken will be divided among you. It'll bring all the nations together to fight Jerusalem. They will capture the city and rob the houses. The women will be attacked. Half the people will be taken away as captives, but the rest won't be taken from the city. Then the Lord will go to war against those nations, and he will fight as in the day of battle. On that day, he'll stand on the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives will split in two, a deep valley and so forth, and go down. It says, then my Lord, the God, will come, and all the holy ones will be with him. On that day, there'll be no light, cold, frost. There will be no other day like it. The Lord knows when it will come. There will be no day or night, evening. Even at evening, it will still be light. That time, fresh water will flow from Jerusalem. Half of it will flow east, half of it flow west. It will flow summer and winter. Then the Lord will be king over the whole world. That time, there will be only one Lord, and his name will be the only name. All the land south of Jerusalem, from Geba to Rimmon, will be turned into a plain, and people verse 12, but the Lord will punish the nations that fought against Jerusalem. He will bring a terrible disease, they'll rot away while they're standing up, and then he talks about various diseases and so forth like that. Goes down to the Egyptians. says some of the people who came to fight Jerusalem will be left alive, and they'll come back year after year. They will come to worship the King, the Lord of Heaven's armies. They will celebrate the Feast of Shelters. Anybody know what that is? Feast of Shelters?
Feast of Tabernacles.
I'm sorry?
Feast of Tabernacles.
Feast of Tabernacles, yeah. Pentecost. Okay, and then it says, let's see. Well, I think that was in 13 instead. Anyway. They're talking about an earthly king, and we know.
Thinking about 11, the people shall dwell in it. No longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited.
Yeah.
Is that the one?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So they're gonna. Then God's gonna set up, or Jesus is gonna set up his kingdom in Jerusalem on his second coming, and that's where he's going to reign. You think that's correct? Let's look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And verse 13 through 17. Somebody read that.
But we do not want you to be uninformed, brother, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord shall not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words.
What's that telling us there?
No earthly kingdom.
Kingdom is in heaven with
Christ. Yeah. He says the Lord is coming. And what's he going to do with the faithful?
They shall rise from there.
Yeah. Let's take a look at John 18 and 36.
Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm."
Yeah, my kingdom is not from this, in another place. How do the Calvinists apply that? About the same way that they apply baptism, probably. Okay. Jesus described what he was going to build in heaven for us, didn't he? No?
Did I go to prepare a place for you?
And when I've prepared my place for you, I'll come for you. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Wasn't in Jerusalem, was it? Earthly Jerusalem. No. That's basically all I've got tonight. We did a quick run through the last three chapters, but it's next week we want to take a look at Malachi, and that'll finish us up for the Minor Prophets, and then we'll go from there. Oh, we had a lot of people tonight. That's great. Really nice to see everyone.
A lot of people on Zoom, too.
Yes. I didn't have a whole lot of the lesson either. But anyway, yeah, great. It's fascinating, but I understood about half of it. That's about it. It's kind of hard to explain. So you just kind of got to read between the lines, look at various things that you can apply to the meaning. But it's kind of up in the air. And it's a little confusing to me. So anyway. That's it, kids. So, anybody have any comments, questions? Bobby? No? Just scratching.
Well, the main thing I've gotten out of the whole study is that God's very jealous of his people. He loves us. But he wants us, just like a parent, he wants us to obey him and do his will. And we see all through history, especially in the Minor Prophets, how again and again and again his chosen people refused to do that and even told his prophets that we're not going to listen to you. We don't really care what you say. We're doing this our way. To the point that God turned his back on them and refused to even hear their prayers or listen to them. And it's foolish for us to think that we're any different today. That we need to listen to what God has to say.
Well, you know, so many people look to, well, they don't even believe in God, and then the ones that do don't really think he cares all that much for them.
Well, I personally think, as Christians, that we are very slack and lackadaisical about the scriptures that encourage us in the New Testament to be separate from the world. And I'm constantly asking myself, Well, what does that mean for me to be separate from the world? And am I accomplishing that? And so I'm not accomplishing that all the time. And if you listen to Dean in his sermons, he says, oh, well, I'm not either, but I'm trying. And we're encouraged to be trying and to be thinking about what the people in the world are doing. And question ourselves when we step up and start doing those things too. Do we want to be with them or do we want to be with the Lord? You know, and it covers a whole bunch of stuff, doesn't it?
Yes.
Entertainment, our speech, where we go, what we do, how we act, how we treat one another, what we wear. That's serious stuff to be, we should be thinking about.
Yeah, it, I went to a ball game last night. I couldn't help, but well, I had a bunch of college kids there. And some of the clothing, the lack of clothing that some of the people had on at the ball game was, you know, was embarrassing. And you know, you want to go up there and just shake the living daylights out of them, you know, and slap them upside the head. But, you know, we have to live with that every day. And
but we don't have to mirror it.
You do not have to mirror it. You do not have to act like that.
We make a mistake, but we do.
And when you see that, it kind of fortifies you a little bit, you know, to even try harder than you do. And I think that's the secret, is just, you know, it's like we are in this world, but we're not of this world. And we always have to keep foremost in what our goal in life is, and go from there. I felt embarrassed for some of the people that were there. You know, they felt bad as well, and, you know. It's one of those things that you deal with from day to day. Anybody else have any comments?